Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the Pantograph for Friday, January 16th, 2025. I'm going to start today on the front page where we have a very long public service journalism report, and I will then move to national and local news with sports and obituaries in the second half. This journalism report on the front page is quite long, so I'm going to give you a taste of it for a few minutes, and then we'll refer you to the web for the rest of it. So the journalism report, investigative journalism report, has a headline reading, "Cracks in the System. Suicidal woman sent to solitary confinement in jail despite warnings advising against it." And this is by Drew Zimmerman and Annalisa Trofimuk. Let's see here. We also have audio that's an additional feature of this. But I will read for just a little while, maybe into the second page, and then I will refer you to the online portion. So I will start. Despite repeated warnings from medical professionals, staff at the Sangamon County Jail placed 27-year-old Tiffany Rusher, who had a long documented history of suicide attempts and self-harm, in an isolated cell for nearly 4 months, a lawsuit and jail records show. In March 2017, she was found dead with a strip of hand towel wrapped tightly around her neck, according to a lawsuit filed by her family. Doctors had advised jail staff that Rusher should not be held in solitary confinement, noting her dozens of prior attempts to harm herself and her high risk for suicide. Rusher's mother, Kelly Andrews, later sued Sangamon County and Advanced Correctional Health Care, alleging that despite knowing Rusher had attempted to kill herself at least 10 times and had injured herself in 27 other incidents, including swallowing pens, toothbrushes, and other inedible objects similar to the cloth available to her in jail, officials still housed her in conditions medical staff had explicitly warned against. Michael Schmickler, a social worker for ACH, described Tiffany as high risk due to the known danger that she presented to herself, according to the lawsuit. The defendants also knew, or at very least should have known, that placing a person with Tiffany's mental state in solitary confinement would only exacerbate her deteriorated mental condition, cause severe psychological trauma, and make it more likely that Tiffany would try to kill herself, the complaint read. The defendants would admit that Rusher was reported to suffer from mental illnesses and was documented to engage in self-harm. However, they would deny that all her illnesses were known to all defendants, that the referenced illnesses were severe at all times during her incarceration. According to the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority's Death in Custody report, at least 112 inmates died between 2019 and 2022 in Illinois County jails. Of those, 24 were reported as suicides. Nationally, between 228 and 369 suicides of local jail detainees were reported annually between 2000 and 2019, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. As a number of state-operated treatment centers and beds for inmates with mental health concerns in Illinois dwindle, the pressure falls on county jails and community-based clinics to provide restorative mental health services. Even private health care contractors hired to provide medical services to detainees don't always provide mental health professionals. County jail administrators and sheriffs across the state say that handling the needs of people experiencing some of the worst mental health conditions has become a burden too heavy for their staff to carry and for the county to fund on its own. "We're having a mental health crisis," said Rock Island County Sheriff Darren Hart. "It's a challenge in being able to maintain those individuals because we have only a level of care available to us here locally, where the state may have a higher level of care that they can provide." Advanced Correctional Health Care contracts with about half the county jails in Illinois and nearly 400 facilities across the country. The company often partners with community-based organizations like Freedom Behavioral Health to outsource mental health care. Jessica Young, ACH president and CEO, said some facilities use volunteers because they do not have any funding for a behavioral health program. suicide is the number one cause of death in jail, and so it's important to have qualified mental health staff to assess and treat detainees in crisis and to determine when to place detainees on suicide precautions or release them from precautions, said Young. The nationwide suicide rate has grown by over 16% in the last year. Coles County Sheriff Kent Martin said, "The nursing and medical professional shortage makes an already difficult situation worse." Coles County also contracts with ACH for medical services and with Freedom Behavioral Health for mental health services. "We go through two or three mental health professionals a year," he said. He added that Coles County Jail is better off than most of the agencies in the surrounding area, but that having 24-hour mental health care would be ideal. "But as we know, the funding is never there for that," Martin said. Rusher's suicidal behavior while in the custody of the Logan County Correctional Facility continued after her committal to McFarland, now known as the Elizabeth Parsons Ware Packard Mental Health Center. She was then transferred to Sangamon County Jail after being charged with aggravated battery. And that's where I will end it here. There are, following the story also contains a long timeline of what happened to Miss Evans and more information, so I will refer you to the story online. I'm going to move on the front page here to more national news, focusing on Minneapolis with the headline, "Trump May Deploy Troops. Anti-ICE Protests Spur Insurrection Act Threat." And this is an Associated Press story. President Donald Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act and deploy troops to quell persistent protests against federal officers sent to Minneapolis to enforce his administration's massive immigration crackdown. Thursday's threat comes a day after a man was shot and wounded by an immigration officer who was attacked with a shovel and broom handle. That shooting further heightened the fear and anger that has radiated across the city since Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent Jonathan Ross shot and killed Renee Good. Trump repeatedly threatened to invoke the rarely used federal law to deploy the U.S. military or federalize the National Guard for domestic law enforcement over the objections of state governors. "If the corrupt politicians of Minnesota don't obey the law and stop the professional agitators and insurrectionists from attacking the patriots of ICE, who are only trying to do their job, I will institute the Insurrection Act, which many presidents have done before me, and quickly put an end to the travesty that's taking place in that once great state," Trump said on social media. Presidents have invoked the Insurrection Act more than two dozen times, most recently in 1992 by President George H.W. Bush to end unrest in Los Angeles. In that instance, local authorities asked for the assistance. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison responded to Trump's post by saying he would challenge any deployment in court. He already sued to try to stop the surge by the Department of Homeland Security, which says it has made more than 2,000 arrests in the state since early December. ICE is a DHS agency. In Minneapolis, smoke filled the streets Wednesday night near the site of the latest shooting as federal officers wearing gas masks and helmets fired tear gas into a small crowd. Protesters responded by throwing rocks and shooting fireworks. Demonstrators have become common in Minneapolis since Ross killed Good on January 7th. "This is an impossible situation that our city is presently being put in, and at the same time we are trying to find a way forward to keep people safe, to protect our neighbors, to maintain order," Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said. Frey said the federal force, five times the size of the city's 600-officer police force, invaded Minneapolis, and that residents are scared and angry. Homeland Security said in a statement that federal law enforcement officers stopped a driver from Venezuela on Wednesday who was in the U.S. illegally. The person drove off, then crashed into a parked car before fleeing on foot, DHS said. "Officers caught up, then two other people arrived, and the three started attacking the officer," DHS claimed. The confrontation took place about 4.5 miles from where Good was killed. Police Chief Brian O'Hara said the shot man was being treated for non-life-threatening injury. The two others are in custody, DHS said. O'Hara's account of what happened largely echoed that of Homeland Security. Earlier Wednesday, Governor Tim Walz described Minnesota, said what's happening in the state defies belief. Let's be very, very clear. This long ago stopped being a matter of immigration enforcement, he said. Instead, it's a campaign of organized brutality against the people of Minnesota by our own federal government. A Homeland Security official claimed Ross, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer who killed Good, suffered internal bleeding to his torso during the encounter. The official spoke to AP on condition of anonymity to discuss Ross's medical condition. The official did not provide details about the severity of the injuries, and the agency did not respond to questions about the bleeding, how he suffered the injury, when it was diagnosed, or his medical treatment. Ross killed Good after three ICE officers surrounded her SUV on a snowy street near her home. Bystander video shows one officer ordering Good to open the door and grabbing the handle. As the vehicle begins to move forward, Ross, standing in front, raises his weapon and fires at least three shots at close range. He steps back as the SUV advances and turns. And our last story on the front page is focused on state schools. It's a Capital News Illinois story by Peter Hancock with the headline, State Asked to Spend $10.9 billion on Schools. The Illinois State Board of Education voted Wednesday to approve a budget request for the upcoming fiscal year that calls for only a minimal increase in K-12 education spending, a reflection of the state's tightening fiscal condition. Overall, the $10.9 billion request would be a slight decrease from the current budget of just over $11 billion, but that is only because funding for early childhood education, which totals nearly $750 million this year, is being shifted in the upcoming year to the newly created Department of Early Childhood, an initiative Governor J.B. Pritzker pushed in 2024. Otherwise, the request seeks a $350 million increase in the evidence-based funding formula. That's the minimum amount called for under the 2017 law that aims eventually to bring all districts' funding up to at least 90% of their adequacy target. That includes $300 million in direct educational expenses, plus $50 million for property tax relief grants for certain high-tax districts. 10 years of EBF, the upcoming fiscal year, which begins July 1st, will mark the 10th year of the EBF program. When it began in fiscal year 2018, according to the State Board, 168 of the state's 852 school districts were being funded at less than 60% of their adequacy target. Today, none are below the 60% level, but 48 districts are funded at less than 70% of adequacy, and 532 districts are below the 90% target. The proposed increase for the upcoming fiscal year would bring the total amount of EBF funding to just under $9.3 billion in FY 2027. According to ISBE data, however, it would take yet another $3 billion to bring all districts up to at least 90% of their adequacy target. The State Board's budget request also seeks an increase of $151 million, or 13%, in what are called mandated categorical, or MCAT, reimbursements to school districts. Those are mainly non-classroom expenses that school districts have to cover, including certain transportation and special education expenses that are not included in the evidence-based funding formula. Over the last several years, budget constraints have resulted in the state funding only a prorated share of those costs. In the current fiscal year, for example, state funding covers only 60% of the cost of transporting students to special education programs, which is down from 71% in FY 2024. The state also covers only 75% of the cost of transporting students to regular vocational education programs, down from 85% in FY 2024. The proposed increase in MCAT cost would hold the proration percentages level in FY 2027. Before drafting the budget request, fiscal staff at the State Board conducted a series of public hearings to receive input from school officials and other interested groups. The agency also considered economic analyses and revenue projections from both the Governor's Office and the General Assembly. The Governor's Office of Management and Budget reported in October that it expects state revenues to fall below previous estimates over the next several months, resulting in a $267 million deficit in the current fiscal year and a $2.2 billion deficit next year, unless action is taken to increase revenues or reduce expenses. The agency said that that's largely due to changes in federal tax law that Congress approved last summer as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that will result in lower corporate income tax revenue. Meanwhile, the General Assembly's Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability reported in December that it still had confidence the state would meet its revenue targets for the current fiscal year, but it cautioned about uncertainty in the months ahead created by changes in federal tax law. Moving on in local news, we have on page A2 a story by Mateusz Janik with the headline, Normal Extends Street Safety Project. The town of Normal and Illinois State University announced an extension of the safety pilot project that limits cross traffic near campus at School Street, College Avenue, and Mulberry Street. Based on preliminary findings, we are keeping School Street between College and Mulberry closed to continue evaluating safety initiatives at the intersection, said Normal Public Works and Engineering Director Ryan Otto in a news release. Both the town and Illinois State have heard positive feedback about using this area to provide more space for pedestrians in this high foot traffic area. As a result of this extension, southbound traffic on School Street will only be able to turn west, and northbound traffic on School Street will only be able to turn east, according to a news release. Additional signage is being added along School Street. The town and Illinois State heard many comments about this intersection, said Adam McCrary, Director of Environmental Health and Safety at ISU, in the release. We understand the closure created challenges for drivers. We want the community to know their concerns have been heard. Pedestrians voiced strong support for this effort. Our goal is to balance the needs of those using the space and making decisions that are best for the community. The extension allows the town and ISU to continue evaluating how this change impacts pedestrian and roadway safety without significant upfront investment, according to the news release. This is a busy, complex intersection, Otto said. We want to make a data-driven decision and will further review objective data to fully understand how the closure impacted traffic and pedestrian safety. The road was initially closed in September 2025 for a planned semester-long closure, allowing the town and university to review data before making a permanent decision. And inside the front section of the Pantograph today, we have ongoing coverage of the mental health and incarceration story that I started on the front page, including a smaller story here with the headline, Addison Woman Deteriorates in Jail, Awaiting Mental Health Transfer. And this is by the Pantograph staff. Renata Aguilar Hurtado waited in the DuPage County Jail for 63 days to be transferred to a mental health facility after being found unfit to stand trial. Instead of being transferred within the 60-day state mandate, the mother of two lost 50 pounds over the course of her incarceration and died of multi-system organ failure from malnutrition due in part to medical neglect, according to a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the woman's daughter. As a result, DuPage County and its sheriff, James Mendrick, reached an $11 million settlement with the victim's estate. Aguilar Hurtado, 50, who had a history of psychosis and schizophrenia, was arrested on March 19, 2023, on a misdemeanor battery charge related to an altercation at a grocery store, according to a lawsuit filed by her daughter, Crystal Moreno Aguilar. On April 10th, a DuPage County judge ordered that Aguilar Hurtado was mentally disabled and unfit to plea or stand trial, and that she be transferred for mental health treatment by the Illinois Department of Human Services. Although Illinois requires that these transfers take place within 60 days of the ruling, Aguilar Hurtado's transfer would never take place. Over the course of her nearly three-month stay in the DuPage County Jail, Aguilar Hurtado routinely refused food and water, and her cell was repeatedly found with blood, vomit, and feces on the ground. She was also reported to have refused psychotropic medication during her initial psychiatric evaluation, which occurred 6 weeks after she was brought into custody, and no further attempt to convince her to take medication was documented, according to the lawsuit. In her final days, Aguilar Hurtado was found to be confused, weak, and unable to stand on her own. Her last medical assessment on May 30th showed that she had lost about 50 pounds and was vomiting blood. According to the DuPage County Jail's most recent inspection by the Illinois Department of Corrections, the facility's medical team are all employees of the jail. The team is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and is responsible for all health care, including sick call, mental health, and dental. On the morning of June 12th, Aguilar Hurtado was found unresponsive in her cell and cold to the touch. She was transported to Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital, where she was pronounced dead later that day. Her autopsy was performed the following day, and a pathologist determined that Aguilar Hurtado died of multisystem organ failure from malnutrition. Medical neglect during her incarceration was determined to be a contributing factor. While incarcerated, she relied upon correction staff to attend to her medical needs, a situation that was compounded by self-neglect and an inherent inability to make appropriate decisions regarding self-care due to her schizophrenia and psychotic disorder, the pathologist's opinion read. A consequence of these psychiatric and situational factors appears to have been a loss of approximately 50 pounds over a three-month period, leading to failure to thrive. The defendants denied and continued to deny each and every allegation of wrongdoing in this incident, according to a stipulation of dismissal. I'm going to continue also with a column by Susan Hazlett. It's a little lighter in tone, and the headline reads, "The Things We Do for Special Deliveries." Delivery trucks are everywhere these days, bringing goodies from Egg McMuffins to swimming pools directly to our doorsteps. It's not a new phenomenon. From the Wells Fargo wagon in the 1860s to last night's DoorDash, we love our deliveries, and sometimes we're willing to go to great lengths for a special delivery. Years ago, when my husband was a college student, his parents and younger siblings were stationed in Paris, France. My future mate planned to fly overseas to spend Thanksgiving with his family, but the trip took an odd turn when his mother had a request. She could not find a turkey in any of the Parisian markets, so she asked her eldest son to buy a frozen bird in Pennsylvania and bring it with him on the plane in his duffel bag. He loaded the ice block butterball into his meager carry-on and hauled it through three airports, finally arriving at his mother's kitchen. The holiday bird was only starting to defrost. "Next year," he said, "please don't ask me to bring a pumpkin for pie." While not everyone can claim to have transported a frozen turkey over the Atlantic, many of us like to convey our own souvenirs. Like my cousin's children who live in Indiana, they thought an iguana from Key Largo would make a good pet. Imagine my cousin's delight when she opened her luggage to find a scaly stowaway. Before the days of the Transportation Security Administration liquid restrictions, friends of mine brought home 32 bottles of French wine in their carry-on bags, carefully packed in tube socks. Not one bottle broke. In 1998, I made my own trip to Paris with two nieces. We went to the historic department store Galerie Lafayette, where I purchased a stunning white pantsuit. I carefully packed it in my suitcase, along with a bottle of red wine, a gift from the concierge. Before you imagine the worst, this story has a happy ending for a random stranger. As we stood in the airport check-in line, the heavy scent of wine permeated the air. A puddle of red wine seeped from the suitcase belonging to the person next to me. Horrified at the possibility, I dropped to my knees and unzipped my luggage. The white suit was fine, but I pulled the concierge's gift from a side pocket and left it by the counter. Some lucky airport employee or fellow traveler got a complimentary bottle of vino that day. At least when my husband delivered Thanksgiving's main course, the bagged bird had already met its demise. Back when my grandparents farmed and raised chickens, baby chicks were delivered through the U.S. mail live. It's hard to imagine a crate of adorable baby chicks being processed at the post office, but it's true, and still happens today. Day-old chicks are shipped from hatcheries to post offices, where buyers must pick them up within hours of delivery. My grandparents always had a warm brooder house ready and waiting for the little chicks. Unusual deliveries did not stress my grandmother. She was always receiving and sending weird things. She once mailed me a frozen meatloaf when I was a student at Illinois State University. I still remember unwrapping several layers of wax paper secured by a rubber band. She mailed a box of not-so-great apples that had fallen from a tree in her yard to my uncle in California. Harry and David has nothing on her. And she sent my West Coast cousins leaves from deciduous trees so they could experience the fall colors. Similarly, my husband once mailed a whole coconut from Hawaii to his young brother in Pennsylvania. He wrote the address and attached the stamps directly on the husk. I often wonder if postal clerks are amused or amazed when people like my grandma walk through the door with their special deliveries. Neither chicks, nor coconuts, nor frozen fowl stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. To wrap up the first half, I'm going to go to the opinion page briefly, and where we have an opinion from the Chicago Tribune on the food pyramid. And the headline, the editorial reads, "Real food belongs at the base of the food pyramid." Those battling chronic illness know what a long, difficult battle it is to get well again, understanding all too well that old sentiment, you don't realize how important your health is until you lose it. Today, too many Americans live sick. They're fighting rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis, and diabetes. Many are battling cancer and heart disease. Their days are filled with doctor's visits and pill bottles, aches and pains. Chronic illness has become the norm rather than the exception in American life. Roughly 194 million adults report living with at least one chronic condition, including 6 in 10 young adults, 8 in 10 middle-aged adults, and 9 in 10 older Americans, according to a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analysis published in 2025. The share of young adults with chronic conditions rose significantly over the past decade, a sign that poor health is no longer confined to old age. Patients need to receive clear guidance on how diet and lifestyle changes can help. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released a new food pyramid Wednesday that flips the original on its head, quite literally. Gone is the heavy grain emphasis that defined earlier guidance, and in its place is guidance to prioritize whole, nutrient-dense foods. Specifically, new recommendations elevate the role of protein from both animal and plant sources, while scaling back the centrality of grains and advising against consumption of refined carbohydrates such as white bread. Plenty of people are grumbling about the advice on alcohol, which can be summarized as limit it. The USDA food guide pyramid debuted in 1992, and for years was the gold standard on how Americans viewed diet, pushing an anti-fat, pro-carb worldview. For example, guidance included 6 to 11 servings per day of grains, such as bread, cereal, rice, and pasta, versus just 2 to 3 servings of protein, such as meat. Moderation was the key word on booze. Federal dietary guidance has steadily retreated from the grain-heavy 1990s food pyramid, first shifting toward individualized recommendations in 2005, and then in 2011, embracing a simpler, whole food-focused approach. These latest recommendations are refreshingly straightforward, and they mirror much of what plenty of physician and health professionals have long recommended for patients dealing with chronic illness. or who want to get in better shape. Of course, we all enjoy a bit of fried food and some pastry, but we know we feel better when we opt for fruits, vegetables, and healthy proteins. And more than that, things like inflammation, blood pressure, and blood sugar can respond positively when you eat right, leading to improvement in autoimmune, heart, and diabetic symptoms. I'll leave it with that for now. I will return with the pantograph second half shortly.